morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you. I see some of you online, others to see your names, but it's good to see your names or your you, whatever. It's a little bit odd that I'm giving a talk 2 weeks in a row. I have no idea how it happened, but I think someone couldn't make it. So, poof! This body is here. Last week I gave a talk celebrating the vast diversity of Zen practices that people do here, and also I have witnessed people doing elsewhere. Things like gardening, speaking, listening to each other, chanting, practicing zazen, kinhin, other forms of walking meditation, cooking, cleaning toilets, sweeping, calligraphy, sewing, robes, lots of other things. You get the idea. So having really had this wonderful celebration of all that, now I would like to talk about zazen. Zazen, which is such a core element of the Soto Zen tradition. At the end of the talk last week, I quoted Dogen Zenji from his universal recommendation for zazen, the Fukan Zazengi, where he says, although each lineage expresses its own style, they're all simply devoted to sitting, totally blocked in resolute stability. Although they say there are 1,000 distinctions and 10,000 variations, they all just wholeheartedly engage the way in zazen. I don't know if this is true. I don't know all the lineages. So there are all kinds of lineages. So Dogen makes some claims that I could just be like, I don't know. You can make your claim. But he's pointing to something, which is the enormous importance in his vision and of just simple sitting meditation in the most basic style, just sitting down and not even allowing the universe to be how it is, because that's a ridiculous proposition. Like, what would that even mean? But just sitting down and the universes. That's our practice, to just sit down in the universes. And, you know, his claim is he had traveled through China and seen many different practice places, and this was basic. And he looked through the textual tradition, all the old books and scrolls, and was like, oh, look, they keep talking about this. So, you know, one of the things Dogen clearly was looking to do when he returned from China and planted the seeds and formed the Soto Zen school in Japan about 800 years ago, was to reclaim meditation as a practice for everyone. So, and one of the reasons, because in many traditions and in many places, generally speaking, there are monks and nuns who practice meditation, and then most Buddhists don't. That's actually been the historical norm, as I understand it. But even though it's a historical norm, it's not, you know, the Buddha laid out a path that was available to everyone, and everyone can meditate and actually benefit, would be beneficial for everyone. So this tendency of Dogen to want to be like, everyone can do this, and in fact, I'm inviting everyone to do it. One of the reasons that we have Soto Zen in the United States, lots of communities, is this aligns deeply with a whole bunch of cultural movement. So starting at about the 19th century, what scholars will call modernist Buddhism arose, which tended to have this theme. So it had to do with the interaction of longstanding Buddhist cultures and colonial powers coming into the East. That's a complicated story, but one of the things came out was a lot of Buddhist movements in Asia that said, oh, instead of just having the monks and the nuns meditating and communities supporting them, let's kind of reclaim and look back into the tradition for teachings that support all people doing this practice, because we believe it's transformative. And so this is something Dogen was talking about 800 years ago. People have talked about it here and there throughout history. And people, kind of like us probably, and many modernist Buddhists were like, oh, there are people who've been talking about this. They're the ones we want to listen to. And so we see movements born from these kind of teachers. There are a lot of other reasons why Soto Zen is alive and well in America, but this is probably one of them. But another thing that happened with this is an enormous emphasis on meditation. So you see, like in the United States, I know a lot of people think, oh, like Buddhism is about meditation. But when I recently traveled to Vietnam, many of the people I met there didn't associate Buddhism with meditation at all. And meditation was a health practice related, they didn't even know where it was really coming from. It had to do with promoting bodily health. Although the people from the Buddhist tradition I was traveling with were from a fairly modernist tradition, so they were pretty into meditation, which I found out when the bell started ringing at 3 o'clock in the morning to get up and meditate. So anyway, there's this come on in for meditation theme in Dogen. And then the come on for meditation theme is like accompanied by an extremely minimal emphasis on instruction in how to do it, which you may or may not have noticed. So, you know, in many traditions, there are lots of different kinds of meditations. You could go and you receive this one and you learn to do that one and then you move on to the next one. That's all cool. But Dogen Zenji's instructions on meditation are really simple. You know, do not think good or bad. Do not judge true or false. Give up the operations of mind, intellect, and consciousness. Stop measuring things with thoughts, ideas, and views. That's how it starts in the Fukan Zenji. And then it just goes through a long instruction about the body. That for those of us in the tradition who've been around for a long time, they're like, having sat through 8 hours of session today, why am I chanting the Fukan Zenji telling me how to sit? Because I've already been doing it. It's the body. Because the central theme of the practice is to just to put the form into the body that a Buddha looks like or a Bodhisattva. And then I just throw up my hands. It's not about making something happen or getting your mind to be something else or making another thing or attaining something. It's about entrusting your body to the universe. Having said that, people find this maddening. So when we have our people teaching intro to meditation in there, to this kind of instruction on non-attainment, non-objectification, non-grasping, we give the complex instruction of notice the posture and the breath. And probably for many of us in this room, our practice really mostly feels like, oh, I'm just bringing attention to the posture and the breath. But this honors the Fukan Zazengi, which centers the practice in the body, in the way we hold the body. So, Zazen, as I understand it, is a collective practice. So when I came here to meditate, what happened was I walked in and it was super quiet and people were moving in a way that was very foreign to me and that felt uncomfortable. And then I sat down and they weren't moving, which was uncomfortable. And then they rang a bell, they moved around in a way that was kind of uncomfortable. Then we sat down and we weren't moving. And then I was like, oh, actually, not moving is okay. It's quiet. And I'm just in this room with these people, not having to figure anything out, trying to figure out their deal, sort out how they're perceiving me. I'm just looking at this wall, with this body, and these people. And then we're going to all bow to each other and leave. There's an exciting part in the middle where we bow a lot and sweep the floor, but it's pretty minimal. And that's, you know, how I understand practice, is coming into a room with other people and embodying Buddhahood again and again. People are always asking me because I sit up on these platforms and teach, they're like, well, what's it like when you meditate? And I'm like, I don't know, there's thoughts, birds, and I see things, I breathe. I don't know, what's it like for you? But you know, something about the way Buddhism has hit the hyper-individualism, I'll call it hyper-individualism, of many Western cultures, is that it's pretty common. You know, I meet a lot of people, I teach mindfulness outside of Zen communities, and people really think, oh, meditation is just something you do by yourself. You can get up in the morning, you put in the app, you do meditation, it's going to improve your mood and your performance. Oh, productivity, what? That's not what I'm doing this for. Improve your bodily health, there's a lot of science on that. But there's just something about this sense that it's just like, how do I just do this by myself? And Zazen is in particular collectivized. So this is not very explicit in the textual tradition we get from Dogen. I don't know why, but if you actually read the text, you can see they're all delivered in the context. Well, the Shobu Genzo isn't, but the, I know this is nerdy. The Eihei Karuku, it's like I'm standing alone with people. We've been practicing Zazen together all day, and now I'm going to say something, which, by the way, is usually very weird. But anyway, the context in which he's teaching is one, it's like we came into this building to do this practice together. And that's very clear, and that is the way Soto Zen has been carried forward, and it's the way Katagiri transmitted it to this space. He didn't say, as they do in some Tibetan traditions, I'm going to go to places, I'm going to give you an extensive instruction in how to meditate and the next steps for you, and then I'm going to leave and I'll be back next year, which is totally cool. I exposed myself to that. He said, we're going to come in this room together and we're going to live together. And a big part of how we're going to live together is just by sitting here and not doing anything. Wow. And you might think, well, why? If you do it for a while, you start to notice things are different. Isn't it true? I don't know. Like my relationship with my teacher, Tim, you know, I've had a lot of meetings with him, you know, one-to-one Dokusan meetings and gone to classes that he's taught. But I would say the majority of the time we spent together, I've been looking at a wall and he's been looking at the floor. And I love him. And my love for him is profoundly deepened by the mysterious thing that happened when we just sat in the room together and didn't figure anything out or try and explain each other or try and learn each other's personal histories, which is all cool. I'm not saying those things are bad. But there's something about the love of bodies in a room just being bodies that is particularly revealed when we strip away everything else besides just being bodies and rules. And I see this again and again, you know, I've seen it here a million times, but the example I use is I led a Shin at Jikoji in the Bay Area a month or two ago. And yeah, I mean, all these people come together. That's not, it's, there were a lot of people there who didn't know each other at this session. It wasn't quite as tight knit. And we were doing 11 40-minute periods of Zazen per day, and the whole thing was in silence. We sat there for 3 days. As they came in, there wasn't a lot of organized, like, we're going to get to know each other. People kind of wander in. It's a residential place, find their spot, and just enter this silence together. And, man, by the end, there were people who had never met. They were just, like, giving each other these big hugs. Ah! Like, how did that happen? They have no idea, like, what's your job? Where do you go up? Just know the deep connection that comes when you put the bodies in the room together and shed all the activities of mind to create division, figuring things out, measuring things with thoughts, ideas, and views, as Dogen says. So there's something about this practice, though, that does create what came to me as I was like, we've got to write a Dharma talk. The term that came up was a settled body. A settled body. I see this, people who practice a lot of Zazen walk into a space where there's difficulty and their bodies are less activated than the other bodies. Because their bodies are accustomed to sitting down in a room full of people and then having occasionally enormous emotions come up or amazing imaginations of the past or the future that are very activating, and realize all this can happen, I can witness it, I can care about it, and my body can just be totally still. Except for maybe your heart. That might be happening. Oh, you can see that. Oh. And settle around it. Settle around it, because your awareness is big. It includes how far away are those birds? That's part of your body. Your heart is small. It's important. It's not overwhelming. Not everything has to pour there. How do I manage this? Well, this is part of the whole thing. I care. And we just see people able to be, have this settledness. And, you know, I just remembered an instance from years ago where I was, and I say things like this, I'm like, people are always going to try and figure out who this is, but whatever. People in my family were fighting, and it was like, they're really mad at each other. We're trying to, you know, clean something to prepare for an event. We're going to have people over. So it's very joyful. We're going to clean the house to make it ready, and people were really mad at each other. And this happens. You get stressed when you have to have people come into your space and all that stuff. And I was just like, well, I could use my normal conditioned response and try and fix everything and manage everybody, which is a speciality of mine. Or I could just know this settled body. And I could just keep cleaning, not because I'm trying to avoid their conflict, but as a way of being radically present to it. Without messing with it, without trying to fix, judge, or control it. And whether that was the best thing to do, I don't ultimately know. It seemed pretty good. The conflict died down. We all love each other. We all argue. Sounds like samsara. One of the coolest things I ever saw in terms of the settled body happened in this building years ago when the Zendo was on that side in that small room. And there's like this, there's a big aperture to enter. And anyway, I found out about this afterwards because I was looking at a wall, but apparently a squirrel walked into the Zendo. And the way it's set up would be kind of like if the squirrel walked directly between me and the Doan, which is Ramon in this case. So it's like, boom. And, you know, it was classic. Tim just like, eyes are open. And the Doan was like, this is my job. My role here is to take care of the space. And it was, I think it was Andrew. His last name escapes me. He just stood up slowly. Slowly enough that the squirrel didn't move. And just put himself between the Zendo and the squirrel, with the squirrel with his back to the door, and just started slowly walking. And the squirrel, there's multiple apertures. And the squirrel just walked back towards the door. Andrew opened the door. And the squirrel left. The settled body. The squirrel didn't have to be like, scary. I was like, yeah, we love squirrels, but it's probably not a good place for squirrels. So that's why we have a longstanding tradition of every gathering, there's a assigned squirrel usher at MCMC. That part violated my vows not to lie, so I'm sorry. I'm just going to quote something about the settled body from Resma Menakem, who's like he writes about embodied awareness, in particular in relationship to dismantling racist structures. And he's a trauma therapist, so it kind of comes through a Western trauma lens. But he's talking about how the subtle distinction, which we often make here between trying to calm yourself and actually being settled. So he says, referring to trying to calm yourself or avoid how you are rather than actually being settled. He says, we do this more often than we realized. In fact, sometimes when we think that we're settling our body, we're actually avoiding its experience. As I wrote in My Grandmother's Hands, which is quite a good book, few skills are more essential than the ability to settle your body. If you can settle your body, you are more likely to be calm, alert, and fully present no matter what is going on around you. A settled body enables you to harmonize and connect with other bodies around you while encouraging those bodies to settle well and creating possible somatic alignment. It's very weird because I feel bad quoting Resma because he sometimes seems kind of annoyed that Buddhists are so into his, he's like, you're appropriating my thing. But it's like, that is exactly what I'm talking about. Not avoiding the experience, but really letting it be there, and somehow that makes a space where other bodies can settle. That's why Tim came in here and sat every morning for all those years. He wasn't like, you should sit like this, or this is how to do it. He just sat there, and I sat there, and something happened. A somatic alignment of connection, of peacefulness, of settledness. So, when I was thinking about collective embodied practice, I also just thought of another kind of beautiful occurrence, which was during the trial of Derek Chauvin at Hennepin, which happened in Hennepin County, the guy who murdered George Floyd. There was like a space lined up in Hennepin County for people to have, they call it a free speech zone. They call it a free speech zone. I've stood on a line and had a police officer say, well, you can't cross this. That would be outside of the free speech zone. Let's not get into that. Anyway, in the free speech zone, one day, a bunch of people who, it's a kind of a loose group called the BIPOC Sanghas for Direct Action, called for many, many people to come in and just sit and practice Zazen in the space. And so there was a lot of organizing, and there were probably about 80 people there. And we just came, practiced meditation together, and then there was like a little yoga instruction and some social, like connection, just connecting with each other, and then another meditation, and then we dispersed. And it was quite beautiful. And, most of the people there, although there were many people from MTFC there, most of the people there weren't practicing Zazen. A lot of them were Vipassana practitioners or from all different traditions. But something about like what we're doing here, we're not trying to make something happen specifically. We're certainly not about just trying to come and do some cool thing with our own mind so that we attain some other state. We're just coming here to be bodies in this space and embody a settledness that we have belief will be beneficial in the world. Pretty simple. Pretty simple. And when about 20 of us from MZMC went over to the vigil at George Floyd Square last week, we didn't practice Zazen there because we were just staying in touch with the organizers and saying, what would you like? And they said, we would love people of religious faith to come, people in religious garments. They didn't say, come and just go and do your own religious practice. So we didn't. We just came and we showed up in the way we were invited. And it was powerful and beautiful, and I was really grateful to be there with folks. So I want to do a little meditation practice. So I'm going to talk about how Zazen doesn't involve almost any instruction and there's no technique, and then I'm going to give you a guided meditation, which will, by definition, involve instruction and technique. So anyway, I'm just going to invite you to find a posture that you find conducive to meditation. And this was kind of an intuitive process creating this. So this has to do with this body, all the bodies, and but also with awareness. And so I'm going to invite you to begin with the eyes closed. And just let the awareness settle in the breath. I'm going to invite you to think of someone who you love, you have a substantial amount of good feelings about, but has recently or occasionally does something that really bothers you. I wonder if anyone doesn't. All our loved ones don't fit in that. Anyway, so someone you really love, have really good feelings about, but maybe something recently happened or there's kind of a pattern that you get up, feel upset about. It's probably best not to think of something really horrendous. And I'm just going to invite you to imagine this person and the situation in which you find them irritating or upsetting. And as you bring up this imagination, just focus on whatever happens with the body. The subtle sensations in the body. And it's never great to spend too long with meditative exposure therapy, so you can just put down the recollection of the frustrating or irritable thing, but try and keep the image of this person that you love and instead start to call up your sense of love and appreciation for them. And if you want to use words, you can use words, or if you just want to sort of imagine and feel your body in proximity to them. Just finding some way to recall your love and appreciation for this person. Now we can let this imagination go. I'm just going to invite you to now really try and actively bring awareness to your own body, the whole body, from the contact with the ground. Breath all the way to the top of the head. We're going to extend our awareness and broaden it to include all the bodies. So if you're online, you may need to look, maybe other people in the room with you, or you can look at your screen where there are people's bodies shown as visual images. If you're in the room, you can open your eyes so they're about half open. And begin to actively extend your awareness so you're focusing on all the bodies. Maybe visually, maybe bodies are making sounds. Why don't we all just share a bow, if you'd like.
So yeah, feel free to reorient the body. It's interesting how when the body settles in this way, it also has this impulse to afterwards realign itself frequently. We see bodies do this.
Yeah, so we have lots of opportunities to move from this more internal awareness to broader. Just when we're in Zazen, we stand up and turn towards the room and orient ourselves for Kinhin together to move. Just a gentle broadening of awareness, like a breath in and out. So when Dogen says we should practice Zazen in his Fukan Zazengi, or at least invites us to. He's recommending it. Ooh, man, it's almost like I should. Jeez. Dogen. It's a fiery teacher. He starts by saying the way is originally perfect and all-pervading. How could it be contingent on practice and realization? The reason to practice Zazen is because everything is already realization. Now, the rational explanations for that are really beautiful, and I'll give them some other day. Other people will too. The direct experience of people who have preached this for thousands of years are very beautiful. But in some sense, there is an evocation of faith that you can trust reality, that you can entrust your body to the whole, and you don't have to figure something out or do something. You know, in the Heart Sutra, which we chant here five mornings a week, it says bodhisattvas rely on prajnaparamita. They rely on it. And that's how they attain anuttara samyak sambodhi, absolute, perfect, unexcelled enlightenment.
Ooh,
that sounds exciting. Now they rely on it. Prajnaparamita is just the awareness that the divisions that are presented to us by our mind aren't absolute realities. That this moment is whole. It's a good reason to just settle. Anuttara samyak sambodhi. Absolute, complete, supreme enlightenment. It's the second to last thing in the I've been teaching from Vasubandhu's treatise on three natures. He says, you'll realize this anuttara samyak sambodhi, and then you'll realize the body. Then you'll realize the body. You realize what the body is. It's this immediate experience of a body, and it's the whole universe. And it's utter, blissful, joyful engagement in the sorrows of the world. No problem! There is an evocation of faith that these teachers are engaged in. But you see people doing this, right? You see people joyfully engaging in the sorrows of the world. Look around. I'm not going to list them. They're out there. So Zazen is a collective practice in the sense that it has traditionally been done by people coming together in a room to embody the universe, but
It's a collective practice in a much broader sense, in that it is total engagement with the entire universe. Normally, we just engage with this tiny made-up thing, which is the way we're thinking and the way we see the world. Zazen is total engagement with the entire universe. It's just a seeing that that made-up thing isn't absolutely real. In Dogen Zenji, in the Bendoa, in the section that's often called the Jijyu Zamai, says, when even one person at one time sits in Zazen, they become imperceptibly one with each and all the myriad things and permeate completely all time, so that throughout the past, the future, and the present, and throughout the limitless universe, they are performing the endless and ceaseless work of guiding beings to enlightenment. Is that lofty enough for you? Wow, permeate completely all space and time with just a love that's not a love that's trying to make something else, but it's a radical availability to what is and a giving yourself to what is. So this section goes on. It says, when even one person at one time sits in Zazen, they become imperceptibly one with each and all the myriad things and permeate completely all time, so that throughout the past, the future, and the present, throughout the limitless universe, they are performing the endless and ceaseless work of guiding beings to enlightenment. But this is not limited to the practice of sitting alone. Zazen only? What would that even mean? I don't know anyone who doesn't have to pause to go to the bathroom. So, you know, if you're just doing a modest amount of meditation, Zazen, like 2 or 3 hours a day, it's okay. It's okay, you can do other stuff. The emphasis on meditation here is important in this tradition. It's important, it's transformative. But we can start to see that our life can actually not just be the habituated thing we were trained to do, but it can be an embodiment of the Eightfold Path, where meditation isn't like, oh, it's a little another thing on my list of things to do, but it's just like, this is what life is about, liberating beings from suffering. Issan Dorsey, some people say, was the first out gay person to ever be ordained as a Soto Zen priest. I actually think that's a claim we can't accurately make. I'm not sure. But anyway, Issan was practicing at the San Francisco Zen Center. His story is amazing because he was like a drag performer professionally for years in like the late 50s and 60s, traveling around the country in drag shows. He was also a notorious drug addict and had some problems. But it's an amazing story. Is the book about him named Street Zen is quite wonderful. But at some point, he was like, oh, I want to do something else. I'm going to put on drag like this. What we call in my queer circles a clergy drag. And devote himself to Zen practice. And he was, I can't remember the details, but he's very associated with the Hartford Street Zen Center. He's probably the founder, which was near San Francisco Zen Center. San Francisco Zen Center was getting very big. Hartford Street Zen Center was nearby, and the Castro was pretty small. And Issan was running a Zen Center. And then, the AIDS crisis started. And, you know, he was deeply embedded in the apex of where that plague occurred. So when I talk to people from that community, they're just like, I remember when many, many of my friends were dying. And I personally have had a couple friends die during that period as well. But apparently it's really, San Francisco is just terrible. And if you recall, people were utterly alienated. So one, the government was like, well, since this is like some kind of gay plague, we're not really going to invest in caring for it. And there was a culture of sort of ostracization. These people are scary, they're gross, they're aberrant. And, you know, it was like people were scared to touch or go near people with AIDS. I mean, there was ignorance about how it was spread, but still there was just a whole culture of the alienation from queer folks. Anyway, Issan's got this Zen Center, and he said,
Well, he didn't say it. He just was like, oh, we've got a room upstairs. And he started taking people who were dying on the street and putting them in the Zen Center. And he founded the first Zen hospice. And he didn't really know what he was doing. He's like, what I'm doing is not letting these people die alone on the street. And there are stories of him literally picking people up off the street and carrying them into the Zen Center and putting them in bed. Anyway, so this, you know, amazing, amazing. And Steve Stuckey used to be the abbot of San Francisco Zen Center, but I think he was not yet the abbot. And people were a little bit like, this is really amazing and inspiring what you're doing, Isan, but it's also like, would Suzuki Roshi have done this? You know, we're supposed to be carrying the Soto Zen tradition. You know, people were kind of confused. Is this the right, we don't know. So anyway, Steve Stuckey was sitting, there's like some kind of garden plot, I guess, at Heart Retreat Zen Center. He's gardening with Isan. He said, he was like referring to globally turning your Zen Center into a hospice. And he said, a hospice for people dying of AIDS. And he said, Isan, what are you doing here? I just heard this story recently from someone who was there. He said, what are you doing here? And Isan said, Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi. Absolute, supreme, perfect enlightenment. That's the thing bodhisattvas rely on in the Prajnaparamita. That's the entrance into the body in the treatise on three natures. He's like, I'm doing my practice. I train to be with bodies, so I'm being with bodies. I'm so happy to be with these bodies. You may think if you're on the Zoom meeting, it's like, oh, we're not in our bodies together. Guess what? I can see you. Do you know how I know the bodies in this room? Through the faculty of vision. Every once in a while, I can smell people, but that's not that common. Sometimes I can hear them, but I can hear you. People say like Zoom is disembodied. Ultimately, we know the world through our senses. We can open up to them however they are presented and be together. And that's the practice. Thank you. All right, well, now it's the time for other people to say things. You're welcome to reflect or ask as you wish. Go ahead. And if you're in the room, please speak with a full voice.
So first of all, thank you. Second of all, I really appreciated the distinction that you talked about between calming down as an act of avoidance versus settling into the body and being more present with what's happening. And I was wondering if you could speak to that a bit more, or just advice for the moment about how to help with that.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's a kind of big topic. So one, it can be very beneficial to use calming techniques in order to sort of not be overwhelmed. So this is not a denial of the value of calming techniques, which we can often use in meditative or learn in meditative contexts. So certainly for me, I've told this story a million times, but when I came here, I was like going through all this trauma therapy and I was freaking out most of the time, but I was like, I'm gonna be mindful all the time. And I went up to Tim and I was like, I'm trying to be mindful all the time, but it's so overwhelming. My body just freaking out under all these tears and rage. And he was like, have you tried watching TV? So broadly speaking, finding ways to care skillfully for how we are is important. But, you know, that was couched in the context that he knew I was devoted to this much more simple practice, which was seeing the whole of the body. So, you know, a basic Zazen instruction, we don't control the breath. We're not trying to control the mind. We're just knowing the breath, knowing the posture. So in this approach, there isn't any attempt to calm anything. But what happens is you may get some subtle seeping in of like, oh, maybe if I just, I can get this just right. And you can just notice that and not try and calm that. That's another thing not to calm. So it gets, there's a very gross level that I'm talking about, and then a much more subtle level of just seeing how you're unconsciously trying to control your experience and who you are, and just being able to open the hand. Thank you.
Ben?
Yeah, Ashley.
Ashley. So I've noticed in my meditation that I get really fidgety, and it's like kind of like this physical anxiety. It's not like my mind is going nuts. It's like my physical body is going nuts. And so I get fidgety, and I talked to Ted about it, and he's kind of said what you had indicated of kind of just being with it and sitting with it and letting it kind of work its way through. And maybe, you know, it'll become more apparent what's kind of sitting in your physical body.
Yeah, that's about right. I mean, we don't want to go overboard. Like, if it feels like you're being swarmed by ants, you want to do something other.
Right, fair enough.
So, having said that, we can develop the capacity to have like all kinds of stuff arise in the body and be settled with it.
Yeah.
So I'm again coming back to these kind of like, there's not so much an answer, but it is really powerful to just sit there and be like, I really, really want to scratch my nose so bad.
Yeah.
And be like, oh, that's like a, there's impulses there and thoughts and
yeah.
Be still. So fortunately you have a longstanding practice, so you can discern effectively.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm really glad that there's people connecting remotely. This is something that I've not thought enough about. I often have a phone conversation with my mother, remotely, obviously, on the phone, and I find myself emptying the dishwasher, sweeping the floor, tidying up everything, and I have no idea I'm doing it. I don't mind doing all those things. I know she's doing it too. What are some subtle ways that we could remind ourselves that we are actually connecting with people, even if we don't have all of our faculties there? Sharing a cup of tea remotely would probably be an easy one, but like what do you all suggest? What do we do? I want to be more present with my mother.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've never tried this. Hey, let's clean the house together. I'll call you at 3:30. I kind of like this idea. You know, for me, because the phone is, you're getting a pretty moderate amount of sensory information. You don't have visual cues. So it's like the listening becomes pretty important. And so I've never talked to someone else about how I'm noticing they seem distracted. That I don't know if that's my place. But what I do is when I notice, I'm like, you know, I sit at my desk, I'm talking to someone, and I got a laptop over here, and I go, mm-hmm. And I just go, oh, I don't have to do that. So I make the choice to just bring myself to listening. A ritual of having a cup of tea is nice, but I'm more excited about cleaning house with people who are far away right now. So, but it is like, we're doing this. Like, it's beautiful to clean your house together. So anyway, that was a really weird answer. But at the bottom, I think it's really worth just when you notice your attention is pulling away from being there for the person on the phone, just say, this is how I'm going to do this. And that may be enough.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hey. I think I'm going to request that you reread the excerpt from Resma. As soon as, well, as it got started, I heard the word harmony, or maybe harm, because all of a sudden I went to the interdependence of those, mm-hmm. and thanking you and the other BIPOCs on the centers for what you did. Awesome. Just thinking a little bit more about Sangha, or global, or communal presence as part of the liberation and suffering and all that. So I didn't hear all the words of Resma.
Well, fun. I'll just read it again. It was harmonize, not harm. There is harm. Yeah, that's part of the dissonance of the sound that we hear, with which we can create harmony. Speaking of trying to kind of control and calm or avoid what the body is giving us rather than really settle within whatever it is, he writes, we do this more often than we realize. In fact, sometimes when we think that we're settling our body, we actually avoiding its experience. As I wrote in my grandmother's hands, few skills are more essential than the ability to settle the body. If you can settle your body, you are more likely to be calm, alert, and fully present no matter what is going on around you. A settled body enables you to harmonize and connect with other bodies around you while encouraging those bodies to settle as well, and creating possible somatic alignment. And like I say, like, this is basically what I understand morning zazen to be. You just come in this room, thump, and something happens. Well, thank you. I think maybe I gotta wrap it. Or I just wrapped it. I just wrapped my talk.